Accession number 25182, reel 3.
So Robert Atkinson, reel 3. After your command of the Anemone, which ship did you move to then?
I moved to HMS Pink, another corvette, but very well equipped with the new squid equipment and radar, really up to date as far as that particular class of vessel went.
Perhaps I should establish what rank you held at the moment. Were you a commander?
No, not at all. Navy don't get promoted like the army. They keep you a lieutenant for a long time until you're 30. But I was a lieutenant only at that time, albeit I did get accelerated promotion later to, again, acting lieutenant commander. Well, my next ship was the Pink, and I must tell you, this was my most important experience was the three consecutive convoys, which Captain Roskill, the naval historian, describes as the three decisive convoys in the Battle of the Atlantic. HX 231, ONS 5, SC 130. It's a matter of coincidence, but yet of fact, that the B7 group was the escort group for those three particular convoys.
What did the B7 group consist of?
About eight ships, a destroyer, the Duncan, a V&W, a very old V&W, a Vedette, and I think four to six corvettes. Now, I would like to mention in this ship, which was a lifetime experience with me and had great influence on my attitude to problems and how to deal with them and people, how to deal with emergency, how to deal with crisis. I will mention the very high degree of training, which was fundamental, and to which B7 group was subject under the command of Commander Gritton.
What did that training consist of, and where was it conducted?
He welded us into a very efficient machine. He saw that we, any leave or any opportunity, the crew went on courses. Signals courses, ASTIC courses, radar courses, tactical courses at Liverpool, every opportunity. He would exercise at sea. He was a brilliant officer, highly disciplined, with a complete overview of the situation at all times. He seemed to have an appreciation where the enemy was, where our ships were, how they were behaving. He was a very hard man, totally dedicated. He was also a very fair man. He didn't ask more of a man than of himself. Let me give you two examples. At first light, at sea, normally, he would send signals around the escorts, clockwise, A, B, C, D, R. Now, he would send those signals in Latin, and you had to produce those signals when you returned to harbour. So it was easy for him to see where a mistake was made. It wasn't unknown for him to make a deliberate mistake. And if your signals were not very good, he would ask that you were sent your signalman for further training instead of leave and return to harbour. On one occasion, he ordered me to alter course. And when we came back to harbour, he said, on such and such a date, at such and such a time, I ordered you to alter course. It took you 37 seconds before your mast showed the change of course. Where were you? Well, I would say, I may have been down for good reasons, but by and large, I was on the bridge. Well, you should ensure that even if you're not on the bridge, your officers alter course immediately without recourse to you. So he was a very exacting man, but as I've said, an extremely fair man.
How long did the working up of this group last? How long did the training of this group last? B7 group.
How long did it last?
Yes, the exercises, sea exercises.
You mean at sea?
Yes.
Well, he couldn't do much exercises at sea, but occasionally we were a very distinguished group, and sometimes we didn't have a convoy. We were just sent there as a striking force. And if a convoy was, we would go to that particular, so we'd exercises at sea and all that sort of thing. He never left you alone, even in harbour, your period of time. He wasn't, he was a very self-seeking man, and he died and worked himself to death. But he was about to be appointed 5th Sea Lord, and on the way to Malta he broke down. He was never quite the same again. Shall I go on?
Yes, please.
Now, on the eve of the very decisive battle of the convoys, which there were three convoys, HX231, ONS5, SC30. On the eve of the decisive battle for ONS5, we received a signal from the Admiralty stating, you are encircled by approximately 32 U-boats. You may expect attack from down moon at approximately 0230. Hoppers 5 at night, 27 miles south of Cape Farewell. A gale blowing. What do you do? Well, I said to you we were a highly trained group, and we were. Whenever the Americans had anything like this, they never stopped gabbling on the telephone. Commander Gretton sent round a signal to the escorts, to each captain. One word. Anticipate. That was all. We were so highly trained, we knew exactly what to do. What did I do? I cleared lower deck of the whole crew and went onto the mess decks and said, listen to this. This is a signal we've just received. I'm not sure how many of us will live to see daylight, but I intend to do so. And this is what we will do. We will have hands to tea at 6 o'clock. We'll have pipe down at 7 o'clock. We'll have action stations at 1 o'clock in the morning, dressed in Arctic clothing. Hot chocolate will be served at 2 o'clock, and you expect to be there the rest of the night. Some people didn't sleep, some slept well. You could almost have set your clock. At 2:30, the first ship went up. I have referred already to the very high losses. Now, until the end of March 43, we're now talking about in those 2 months to April, May, We were losing ships at a greater rate than the combined Allies could build them, for example.
Can I continue, please?
For example, in the first 20 days in March alone, 97 ships were lost. That's at the rate of 145 ships per month. Convoys were being mauled by the wolf pack because there was an air gap and there was no air cover. Had the convoy system lost its effectiveness? Should it be discontinued? Powerful voices in Admiralty were for discontinuing the convoy system. Yet within a few weeks, Admiral Dönitz and his U-boats had been defeated. And I recall, as Roskill states in his book, there never was a more dramatic change of fortune. The turning point came between the 3rd of April and the 24th of March, May, after SC-130 was 115 ships. Oops, sorry, can I cancel?
Yeah, no, just continue.
The final turning point came between the 3rd of April and I think the 24th of May, after SC-130, when Admiral Dönitz withdrew his U-boats to the Azores. Now, these figures are accurate figures I'm now going to give you. During a period of less than 2 months, with the valuable assistance of Coastal Command, who were now able to operate from Iceland, B7 Group alone sank 19 U-boats for the loss of 15 merchant ships, nearly half the total of the 41 U-boats sunk in May from all sources.
Why do you think the group was so effective at sinking U-boats at that time?
Because the group was highly disciplined, very well trained, officers who had been tried and tested under all circumstances were able to deal with the crisis.
Were new tactics employed? Was there anything that changed?
In what?
Were new tactics of any sort employed?
I think we had now better equipment. As I just mentioned, we were now receiving air support from southern Iceland, albeit it was the Americans who converted some of their super bombers for our benefit, having been refused any planes from Bomber Harris, who was very busy using all the planes he could get in Europe. We had the Squid, which was the latest. We had good radar. The merchant ships, bless them, were extremely well trained and disciplined at keeping position after all the years of experience. And I think the coordination, we became quite efficient units. Some more so than others. I think Captain Walker and Commander Gretton had the two most powerful groups of all time, due to the aptitude of the commanding of the senior officers. I mean, Gretton was brilliant and so was Walker. And their staff officers in Aztecs were extremely able men.
And what was the role of your ship, HMS Pink?
HMS Pink was just one of the escort vessels, the same as any of the others. We had no special position.
And what part in the action did you play?
In which particular...
May, in the sinking of the...
Very interesting, because the books that have been written, one refers to Pink's convoy, because The convoy was split up due to bad weather and torpedoing. And I broke away with, I rounded up four ships and took them on my own. Unfortunately, Peter Gretton ran out of fuel and had to go to Greenland and left the convoy. And the captain of the Sunflower, who was the next senior officer, took over the role. Because I had become detached, he asked the Admiralty to treat me as a separate convoy, as he didn't want, he couldn't deal with me, he had his own problems. I couldn't catch up the convoy. I had rounded up four or five ships, and I was proceeding to Newfoundland as best speed I could. And the speed of the convoy is the speed of the slowest ship. So you have a large convoy and a small convoy, and he asked the Admiralty to treat me as a separate entity. So I set off with my four, five ships to Newfoundland.
How far away from Newfoundland were you at that point?
Oh, a long way. We were just south of Cape Farewell, and each day, you know, a little bit west of Cape Farewell. So quite a long way to go. Nova Scotia and so forth. The highlights of that convoy to me were proceeding with my five ships. I got a contact. Now, in his book, Admiral Gretton said, I made a mistake. My job was not to sink submarines. My job was to protect the convoys. But he said it was a human thing. Having got a contact, I'm the last man in the world to let go. So I attacked that convoy, I attacked that submarine and sank him. And then, having left my convoy, because it took several hours, they were now miles ahead of me, unprotected. So I set off at full speed to catch them up. My worst fears materialized. Just as I came up to the convoy, a ship was torpedoed out of my five, a ship called the West Mattaquette. I was sad, but I dropped depth charges all over the place to keep him down, and I saw the West Mattaquette lifeboat swing out and into the sea. Very tricky situation. There's a submarine lurking there, waiting for you to stop. So my manoeuvring, stopping, going stern and all over the place, I suddenly came alongside the U-boat, the lifeboat. Lo and behold, about 40 seamen, all with their suitcases packed in a lifeboat. Marvellous. The chief gunner's mate said, "Look, sir, what do you think of that lot? We're not going to stop for that, are we?" "No," I said, "tell them to come on board or stay on board. Leave the luggage." Well, they didn't want that, because we had a big net down the side. You climbed up the net and you were out. And I said to the gunner's mate, when the boat was cast adrift with all their suitcases nicely packed, "You want some machine gun practice?" "Yes, sir." "Try the Erlikons." And we steamed away, and we laid off with the Erlikons, and the boat evaporated with the gunfire on fire. Said to the captain, "Have you got your documents with you?" "No." "Where are they?" "Left them on the chart room table." "Panic." "Well, I said, I'm afraid I'll have to sink the ship, because she isn't sinking. She was torpedoed, but she hadn't sunk." So we steamed around again with two to three depth charges. We came close up one side, threw them under her, and broke her back, and she went down in 2 or 3 minutes. They were a poor lot, That crew, worst I've ever seen. Second worst I've ever seen. Because they wouldn't sleep below decks, although our crew made them welcome on the mess decks. No, they said they'd stay on the upper deck. I'm sure that was the first to be to our lifeboats in case anything happened to us. So we didn't think very much of them. Later in life, looking up the records and seeing the German records, the submarine that torpedoed the West Mattaquette claimed he had sunk the West Mattaquette. I had an American professor over here doing research. And he said he'd seen this man and met him. Would I like to meet him? I said, no, I don't want to. Past chapter. I don't want to go to Germany and talk to anybody. But when you next see him, tell him he didn't sink the West Mattaquette. I did. So I enjoyed that one. However, we claimed one U-boat. We lost one of our sheep, and we got the other four back to harbour. That was my part in ONS 5. Albeit, before we were detached, there had been a lot of action, night and day, as I mentioned, Anticipate and 0230, and that morning the first ship went up. I would like to give you a few more details, if I can remember them. In those three convoys I mentioned, the B7 group sank 19 U-boats for the loss of 15 ships. That's remarkable. More U-boats than ships. And this is how the story unfolded in those three convoys. You had HH3231, homeward bound convoy. Two merchant ships were lost. Three U-boats were lost. You had ONS-5, where 12 merchant ships were sunk, and 11 U-boats. And then you had SC-130, where no merchant ships were lost, and 5 U-boats were sunk. And it was on that basis of 15 ships lost and 19 U-boats sunk in three convoys that forced Admiral Dönitz to declare he had been defeated, and he withdrew his U-boats to the Azores. And sadly, in that convoy, he lost his own son.
Can I ask you about the details of
what
it was like living day to day through that period? And what happened when you were at action stations and you had sight of a U-boat? Can you just talk me through the nitty-gritty of it all?
Yes, we're a pretty seasoned lot. You know, this was well into the war, 4 years of convoys. And we went to sea at that time expecting battle. We rather looked forward to it. You got a few chickens who got very excited and etc., had to be dealt with. But by and large, even the merchants were very well experienced, and the Battle of the Atlantic was won by the perseverance and dedication of all concerned, and the coordination of the merchant ships, the naval ships, and later, with very good effect, the aircraft, who could spot ahead of you and tell us where, how many there were, and where they were. We felt it was a normal routine. I've been asked this question before, how did you feel about going out for this particular convoy? Well, we didn't know what we were going to expect. To us, there were normal convoys. It was later we found that these three decisive convoys had put paid to Dönitz's ambitions. You see, Churchill himself said at that time the only fear he had was the Atlantic, where our supplies would fail. which would cause them to lose the war. We were conscious of the fact that it was very important to get the homeward bound convoys through, because they were laden to the gills with oil, food, munitions, tanks and things that without which the war could not be continued. So we recognized at the time that we were performing a key role, and we got on with it. Enormous support from Admiralty.
What was it like, Dan? What I'm trying to get at is, describe a day on a convoy. Would you all be at action stations?
No. Only action stations when there was action. Routine, duty, watch keeping, people sleeping at every opportunity. If there was nothing around, you went down for your meals, but you were mostly alert, moving to position. You couldn't stick, you had to move and seek, turn, twist, come up to the convoy, leave the convoy. You were underway all the time, attending various things, merchant ships straggling, getting out of position, dropping back, picking stragglers and so forth and so forth. We kept busy. Action stations, there were long periods of doing nothing at sea, long periods of no action at all. During the war, I actually did a couple of tapestries, which kept you busy. But we were alert all the time. You never had a bath. You couldn't take your clothes off, you see. You slept mostly with your clothes on, and to be alert. You were on edge all the time, some more than others. Some with responsibility would be alert all the time, but the ordinary member of the crew would be getting on with his job, and he wouldn't know what was happening in the Aztec or the radar cabin, for example.
Can you describe what your position was, or what your role was, when you were at action stations?
My role as captain of the ship would be to ensure that all departments were operating. I would stand by on the bridge, doing nothing. The officer of the watch would be steering his course. The Aztec officer would be in the hut, and I would be there to receive any signal that came through from outside or from within. An Aztec contact, a radar contact, something from some other ship, etc., etc., being detailed to go. You were the coordinator of all action. An officer in command of a warship has much more authority than the corresponding rank in the other forces. The army, for example, I would never, as a captain of a ship, have the authority in the army. You'd be responsible to a brigadier, blah, 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 right through. But in a ship, you are in command, and that is it.
Could you describe the process, what would happen when a U-boat was spotted, sighted?
When it was spotted?
Yeah.
Well, very often they were not on the surface. You wouldn't get that. If it were spotted on the surface, of course, you would immediately report to your commanding officer, U-boat spotted bearing X, Y, Z, I'm attacking. And you'd go for him, and then he would close in and help or something, or not, you see. If it was underwater and you got a contact, bong, bong, you report your contact and you hold him. You just keep holding him for 200 yards or so, and you keep watching his position. Because early in the war, you had to pass over them before you could drop depth charges, which meant the water was in turbulence. Later, when you had the squid, you could ping him and keep him at 200 yards and then fire your squid to a pattern which would surround him and explode by depth setting rather than by contact. It was much more sophisticated later.
It's Robert Atkinson, Reel 4.